Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
We begin with Eric Holder, who has a birthday this month. That puts him solidly in his mid-60s, 65, retirement age. But there will be none of that for the former attorney general.
I also want to continue to be involved in the fight for voting rights, criminal justice reform, both to speak about it and make sure that I'm a part of the conversation, but then also to be a force, I hope, for substantive positive change in the civil rights areas that, you know, I spent so much time on as attorney general.
He was the first African-American AG, also first black deputy attorney general, first African-American U.S. attorney for the D.C. District, first cabinet official in history to be voted in contempt of Congress for the Fast and Furious investigation. This is something he may actually be proud of, taking a political hit really meant for the president. Eric Holder is in the private sector now, and in a wide-ranging conversation about his career and his years advancing the Obama agenda, he began by strongly endorsing the White House moves on gun control announced this week. Can and will they be enforced by a newly empowered Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms?
The president was pretty clear that there is the need for additional people at ATF in order to effectuate the changes that he wants to bring about. I mean, if you look at the way in which ATF has been treated, it's been a death by attrition, both in terms of the numbers of people, relatively small increases that have occurred, and then the unwillingness by the Senate in this administration and in the prior administration as well to confirm somebody. So both at the leadership level and in terms of the numbers of people brought into ATF to help effectuate these changes, I hope Congress will cooperate.
Gun control and Second Amendment issues were conflict points within DOJ and Congress, certainly in Washington. Another one is voting rights, whether we're talking about the Supreme Court decision or talking about the successful prosecutions and successful cases that you mounted at DOJ. Where do you think the Voting Rights Act is headed?
And my hope would be that Congress would take it up and, in essence, make the Voting Rights Act consistent with the decision, I think the wrongly decided decision, in Shelby County by the Supreme Court. There is the need for a Voting Rights Act that will reach the entirety of the United States. Before I left, we circulated up on the Hill a proposal, a mechanism by which all states could be held accountable, all jurisdictions within the country could be held accountable based on their past actions over the previous 10 years. My primary concern, though, is that we're going to see Congress not act at all. This is something that has become highly politicized. And to be frank, I think those on the Republican side of the aisle see a benefit to a lot of the things that have been brought out in various states, photo IDs, a whole variety of changes that I think under the prior Voting Rights Act, the Justice Department might have opposed.
When would you say the impetus happened for you to think about sentencing reform in the United States as a mission and something that you did really manage to make serious headway on once you were AG?
But my interest in the topic really, I think, began when I was a judge here in the Washington, D.C. Superior Court, where I was faced with sending people to jail for what I thought were inordinately long periods of time, given the nature of the conduct for which they had been convicted. It always was something that bothered me. I saw the impact of these laws on the communities from which people were being taken. And I always told myself if I had the opportunity to do something positive, to change those laws, I would do so. And when I became Attorney General and with the support of the President, this is something that we really decided to emphasize in the second term, having done some things in the first term that I think laid the foundation for the more expansive changes that I outlined in, I guess, in the August 2013 speech in San Francisco.
Do you think some of this was driven by race, particularly as we see it revealed now that the patterns of incarceration were so easily voted in, partly because there was a implicit understanding that they would bear more directly on African-American communities?
Well, I'm not sure that race drove Congress to put in place those rather draconian drug sentencing laws. But I certainly know that as we look back at it now and see who was disproportionately impacted by this, that there was certainly a racial component to it. But, you know, there is no question that the impact of those laws is something that I think was essentially unfair.
When you came into office, when the president came into office, certainly the big story was the financial crisis. And I'm wondering if your mission or your agenda in approaching the job of attorney general changed at all when you understood that the business of governing and the business of certainly the White House was going to be in dealing with the financial crisis.
No, not really. I mean, you know, the financial crisis was something that we knew we had to deal with. I remember we had a cabinet meeting early on where Larry Summers was laying out the depth of the problem. And I remember a chart that we were given that compared where we were in 2009 to 1929. But that didn't really have an impact on, I think, our enforcement efforts at the Justice Department to the extent that we found issues that warranted criminal or civil resolutions. I think, you know, we were pretty effective in that regard.
Do you think there was a conscious decision made to focus on largely on the civil side rather than the criminal side in dealing with punishments to the financial industry post-crisis?
No. I think what you're getting at in a polite way is the criticism that has been raised that, you know, we decided to give individuals in banks passes as opposed to prosecuting them. And I think that's simply inconsistent, again, with, you know, the facts. And what you have to understand is that these are the kinds of cases, if you could bring them, that would be in some ways career-defining and in a positive way for these prosecutors, for these U.S. attorneys. And the notion that we somehow turned our backs on cases that we could have made is just not consistent with the facts. We tried extremely hard to make criminal cases both against institutions and individuals. But given the diffuse way in which the decision-making occurs, given the state of the law, laws that we had, the cases simply were not able to be made. And I think that the numbers that we got in terms of fines and penalties from the banks, those were extremely, extremely effective mechanisms and good deals on behalf of the American people.
But if you're looking at it from the standpoint of one of these bankers like Jamie Dimon, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Jail or pay some money to Eric Holder. Yeah, they're going to take this deal.
A lot of people who are critical here have never been prosecutors. You've got to reach the highest standard in the law, beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to bring a successful prosecution. And to the extent that we could have done that, we would have brought those cases. But we also cannot bring cases simply because we feel that people have done wrong. We have to be able to prove that they have done wrong.
It was quite a ride, you and President Obama there in the administration for two terms.
Mm-hmm.
Did you and the president depart as friends?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's an interesting thing. We were friends before I started. And, you know, one thing I think that people should understand is that he's a good lawyer and understands the need for an independent Justice Department. And he never really interfered in some of the decisions that I made. I'm sure that now that I've left and once he leaves office, there'll be things that he'll want to discuss with me and say, what the hell were you doing, Eric? Why'd you do that? You know, there are things I'm sure that he didn't necessarily agree with or understand. And so I think there's going to be a conversation over drinks that the two of us will have about my time as AG.
Back to the gun control announcement from the president this week. He got emotional there, and there's been much said about that. Certainly, it's not hard to get emotional thinking about what happened at Sandy Hook and those little kids who were killed. But people in the White House have access to information and images and things that others of us don't. Have you seen the pictures of what happened in that room where all those kids were killed?
It was the worst day I had as Attorney General. I went up to Sandy Hook, a few days after the massacre. People, it was a tragic incident. It wasn't a tragic incident. It was a massacre. And I met with the first responders and the crime scene search officers, and they took me around. I looked at the pictures. If the American people had access to those pictures, the American people had seen those pictures, the calls for reasonable gun safety measures would have been passed. If members of Congress perhaps had a chance to see those pictures and see what happened to those little angels, I think we would have seen, a different result. I mean, I came out of that that tour that I took of the school, and they lined up the first responders and the crime scene search officers, you know, grizzled police folks, and everybody was crying. They were crying. I was crying. It was without question the worst day that I had as Attorney General, and maybe the worst day in my professional life.
So those images, you're convinced would have the impact of the pictures of Emmett Till that changed America's civil rights?
I don't think there's any question about that. To see the bodies of these little angels, to see their classroom, where you have this juxtaposition of all this blood on the walls and the little posters that they put up where they stuff like, if, what I want to do this year. You know, kids transpose letters and put a K, you know, facing the other way. And, you know, I don't know, Denise or something, 6 years old, and misspells her name. And to see, you know, that the innocence that created those little pictures about what they wanted to do with their lives in, you know, in first grade that year, juxtaposed with the scene of carnage that you saw that was wreaked by Lanza. It was it's something that haunts me, that stays with me even now. I mean, as we're talking about it, I can bring up the images in my mind, you know, too easily.
Eric Holder served as U.S. Attorney General from 2009 to 2015. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Eric Holder says his office did its best to prosecute the big banks in the wake of the financial crisis. What do you think? Was it an opportunity missed? Framingham, Massachusetts. The problem is Holder is limited to the law. The law is supposed to codify our morals and beliefs of right and wrong. Laws are written by politicians that are pressured to build in loopholes big contributors want that protect them when they do these clearly amoral acts. Campaign finance reform would allow us to see who is pushing what. Then we can vote and do a better job. New York, New York says perhaps his office did its best and the laws are just stacked against them. Or maybe some of that money was helpful to the 2012 election. The rich in this country are becoming increasingly untouchable by the law, especially laws that would repurpose any of their wealth.
Hi, Terry from Portland, Oregon. Eric Holder, good man, good lawyer, no doubt. But to say that we did our best sounds a lot like my dog ate my homework.
Hi, this is John from Ridgefield, Washington. Nothing will really change until we change the culture of business and banking that encourages profits for shareholders and executives above all else, including employees, jobs, and the lives of average American citizens.
We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.